led to skyrocketing prices and rolling blackouts. States like Maryland allowed customers to pick from a menu of producers. In some states, competing private companies offer varied packages like discounts for cheaper power at night. But no state has gone as far as Texas, which has not only turned over the keys to the free market, but has also isolated itself from the national grid, limiting the state's ability to import power when its own generators are foundering. Consumers themselves got a direct shock last week when customers who had chosen variable-rate electricity contracts found themselves with power bills of $5,000 or even more. When they were expecting extra-low monthly rates, many may now face huge bills as a result of the upswing in wholesale electricity prices during the cold wave. The governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, on Sunday said the state's Public Utility Commission has issued a moratorium on customer disconnections for non-payment and will temporarily restrict providers from issuing invoices. There is regulation in the Texas system, but it is hardly robust. One nonprofit agency, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT, was formed to manage the wholesale market. It is supervised by the Public Utility Commission, which also oversees the transmission companies that offer customers an exhaustive array of contract choices laced with more fine print than a credit card agreement. But both agencies are nearly unaccountable and toothless compared to regulators in other regions, where many utilities have stronger consumer protections and submit an annual planning report to ensure adequate electricity supply. Texas energy companies are given wide latitude in their planning and for catastrophic events. One example of how Texas has gone it alone is its refusal to enforce a reservoir margin of extra power available above expected demand, unlike all other power systems around North America. With no mandate, there is little incentive to invest in precautions for events, such as a southern snowstorm, that are very rare. Any company that took such precautions would put itself at a competitive disadvantage. A surplus supply of natural gas, the dominant power fuel in Texas, near power plants might have helped avoid the cascade of failures in which power went off, forcing natural gas production and transmission offline, which in turn led to further power shortages. In the aftermath of the days-long power outages, ERCOT has been criticized by both Democratic and Republican residents, lawmakers, and business executives, a rare display of unity in a fiercely partisan and Republican-dominated state. The governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, said he supported calls for the agency's leadership to resign and made ERCOT reform a priority for the legislature. The reckoning has been swift. This week, lawmakers will hold hearings in Austin to investigate the agency's handling of the snowstorm and the rolling power outages. For ERCOT operators, the storm's arrival was swift and fierce, but they had anticipated it and knew it would strain their system. They asked power customers across the state to conserve, warning that power outages were likely. But late on Sunday, 14th of February, it rapidly became clear that the snowstorm was far worse than anything they had expected. Sleet and snow fell, and temperatures plunged. In the council's command center outside Austin, a room dominated by screens flashing with maps, graphics, and data tracking the flow of electricity to 26 million people in Texas, workers quickly found themselves fending off a crisis. As the weather worsened into Monday morning, 15th of February, residents cranked up their heaters and the demand surged. Power plants began falling offline in rapid succession as they were overcome by the frigid weather or ran out of fuel to burn. Within hours, 40% of the power supply in Texas had been lost. The entire grid, carrying 90% of the electric load in Texas, was barreling towards a collapse. In the electricity business, supply and demand need to be in balance. Imbalances lead to catastrophic blackouts. Recovering from a total blackout would be an agonizing and tedious process, known as a black start, that could take weeks or even months. And in the early morning hours last Monday, the Texas grid was seconds and minutes away from such a collapse, according to Bill Magnus, the president and chief executive of the Electric Reliability Council, ERCOT. If we had allowed a catastrophic blackout to happen, we wouldn't be talking today about hopefully getting most customers their power back, Mr. Magnus said. We'd be talking about how many months it might take before you get back your power. The power outages and the cold weather touched off an avalanche of failures, but there had been warnings long before last week's snowstorm. After a heavy snowstorm in February of 2011 caused statewide rolling blackouts and left millions of Texans in the dark, federal authorities warned the state that its power infrastructure had been inadequate. Winterization protection was inadequate. But 10 years later, pipelines remained inadequately insulated and heaters that might have kept instruments from freezing were never installed. During heat waves, when demand has soared during several recent summers, the system in Texas has also strained to keep up, raising questions about lack of reserve capacity under unregulated grid. And aside from the weather, there have been periodic signs that the system can run into trouble delivering sufficient energy, in some cases because of equipment failures, in other cases because of what critics called an attempt to drive up prices, according to Mr. Hurst of the University of Houston, as well as several energy consultants. Another potential safeguard might have been far stronger connections to the two interstate power-sharing networks, East and West, that allow states to link their electrical grids and obtain power from thousands of miles away when needed to hold down costs and offset their own shortfalls. But Texas, reluctant to submit to the federal regulation that is part of the regional power grid, made decision as far back as the early 20th century to become the only state in the continental United States to operate its own grid, a plan that leaves it able to borrow only from a few close neighbors. The border city of El Paso survived the freeze much better than Dallas or Houston because it was not part of the Texas grid, but connected to the much larger grid covering many western states. But the problems that began with last Monday's storm went beyond an isolated electrical grid. The entire ecosystem of how Texas generates, transmits, and uses power stalled as millions of Texans shivered in darkness, unheated, and in unheated homes. Texans love to brag about natural gas, which state officials often call their cleanest burning fossil fuel. No state produces more, and gas-fired power plants produce nearly half of Texas's electricity. We are struggling to come to grips with the reality that gas came up short and let us down when we needed it most, said Michael E. Weber, a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. The cold was so severe that the enormous oil and natural gas fields of West Texas froze up or could not get sufficient power to operate. Though a few plants had stored gas reserves, there was insufficient electricity to pump it. The leaders of ERCOT defended the organization, its lack of mandated reserves, and the state's isolation from the larger regional grids, and said the blame for the power crisis lies with the weather, not the overall deregulated system in Texas. The historic, just about unprecedented snowstorm was the heart of the problem, Mr. Magnus, the council's chief executive, said. Magnus added, "We've found that this market structure works. It demands reliability. I don't think there's a silver bullet market structure that could have managed extreme lows and generation outages that we were facing on Sunday night." In Texas, energy regulation is as much a matter of philosophy as policy. Its independent power grid is a point of pride that has been an applause line in Texas political speeches for decades. Deregulation is a hot topic among Texas energy experts, and there has been no shortage of predictions that the grid could fail under stress. But there has not been widespread public dissatisfaction with the system, although many are now wondering if they're being well served.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله
Answering your doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs
الله هو ذا الرحمن
الله
هو ذا المنان
لا إله إلا الله
Please send us your emails to our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome once again to another program of Questions and Answers on the Islamic Belief. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and I'm here with Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me.
Why do we use the word huwa, which is a masculine form of saying he to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? That is my first question from one of our dear listeners. Why does the Noble Quran use the word huwa, which is the masculine form of he? Which if we would translate huwa to English, we would say he. Whenever Allah is mentioned, he is seen as huwa, he. And that is, again, similar in other religions too. But here the question is, why? And isn't this a kind of discrimination or sexism?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, the person who has asked the question, he's not been told about the Arabic grammar rules that we have. Or the person, obviously, the way it's been raised in the West or the translation that are there, because these translations could not transfer the actual Arabic word that has been used, we have these problems. That's the first thing. The second thing, in the Arabic language, the word huwa is used for the male, female, and for like things that do not have genders. For example, book. It does not have a male or female. Huwa is used for book as well. Huwa is a pronoun, basically.
Right.
Which can be translated as he or it. The things that do not have any gender, even in the Arabic language, for them, they use the word huwa.
And here.
Here too. Here is specific for the obviously feminine. You know, the translations, the problem
they
is...
They put everything into feminine and masculine.
And the masculine,
all
yes.
the things.
In the Arabic language, if it is feminine, they definitely use here. That is a specific thing. Here is used for a specific feminine gender. Huwa is used for someone who does not have any gender, number one. Number two, for the masculine as well. So huwa has more usage.
But that's the same for here.
No, huwa has more usage. Now, sometimes huwa covers the feminine as well. Okay? Sometimes huwa in the Arabic covers the feminine as well. Now, the problem is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not have any gender. Okay?
Right.
This gender that we have, male and female, this is for this world.
Oh, when we call him Malik, it is just for... I don't know, to pronounce something?
Yeah, it is to pronounce something.
Because the power was usually with the kings?
Yes, with the kings. The queens do not have powers. So we generally, because in the worldly, obviously Quran is talking about, is talking in a way so that humans can understand things.
Right.
That's why it
and
is used
Hoa
as
sounds Hoa. More powerful in the thoughts of
in
human
the thoughts
beings.
Of the human beings, and that's why it is used. Number one. Now, what I was explaining is Allah Subhanahu wa Taala does not have any gender, male or female.
Right.
That's the first thing. The second thing is we cannot use it for Allah Subhanahu wa Taala because He is existing.
Like the angels, by the way.
Yeah. Like the angels, Allah
no
Subhanahu
gender.
Wa Taala. We cannot use it because He is a living. He's an existing.
It's
entity.
Not a thing.
It is not thing.
It's
he is a
being.
He is
it's
a
an
being.
Existence. Right.
He is a being entity who is the necessary being.
So we
basically.
Cannot use it. Right?
We cannot use it. Now, in between she and he, one thing we need to choose.
Right.
In the Arabic language, because it's a vast language, because they use Hoa for female, male, and the ones who do not have any gender, they use this Hoa word over there. That's why this Hoa is being used.
So
Allah
the Hoa, goes back to our mental,
our mentality.
Thoughts.
Yes,
yeah, our mentality.
Now my question:
the human beings. We could have used here too.
My
doesn't
question,
matter.
My question from these people who has raised this question, because they're talking in the obviously the language is English language, and they have taken Hoa from the Arabic language. What about the Persian language? What about the Persian language? The Persian do not have he or she.
Right.
For the male or female, they have one thing. An, u, for
right.
example, an means he, an can be means she.
Right.
It depends on the person. U, when you're saying like he or she or it, it is always u.
Right.
Okay. The Persian language.
Some European
not,
languages too. The same there.
You can give some examples
yeah.
from there as well for
yeah.
them. So what about these languages? They don't have this issue. In their language, for example, in the Persian language, there is no gender. So that's why they do not have any issue with Hoa. Okay?
Mm.
Or here. It's because in this language there is the discrimination of gender the way it has been used. And Hoa has more usage as here. That's why it has come in there. So
right.
it's a matter of using the best word. It's
and
not
it,
the matter of using gender. It's the matter because Allah uses the best
right.
words in order to express anything.
Just to clarify it, so from our perspective, the human being perspective, we say Hoa. Otherwise, from the godly, divine
because
perspective,
he do not have any sex,
Hoa and Hia does not matter.
Matter.
Don't get fixed into these words play, where you play with the words. If you want, you can call Allah for Hia. Or for Malika, as long as it means the same as Malik, it has to go back to the divine power, basically. And to speak about that power, Malik, king, has been used instead of Malika. If the situation of us human beings were different, if the queens were ruling and the hiyas were ruling, the shes were ruling, then we would have to use Hia, the revelation would have come as Hia or Malika and so on.
From another perspective, if I want to explain through the Arabic grammar to our dear listeners, every single word in the Arabic language is made out of a masculine word. For example, if we want to have a feminine word, anything,
it is
you need to
on
bring
masculine.
On the root word.
It's right.
it based on the root word. The
right.
root words in Arabic language are all masculine. Now, it has nothing to do with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, with the God.
Right.
It's the language. It's the structure of language.
Right.
Because it is being made by this. Now, then if we want to say Malika, bringing a ha or ta'i marbuta at the end, we need to first reach to Malik
right.
and then to Malika.
Right.
So it's the, you can say hurdles or, you know, there's more
right.
So
it has nothing
effort
to do.
Should be put in order to make a noun.
Right.
So even for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if we are using the first form of that word, which is Malik, so even that's why Allah has also used this, and we are using this for Allah.
Right.
Because it's much more easier to use, to say.
Right.
It has nothing to do with the gender. That's
right.
what we need to understand over here.
And then we had a male-dominated society, and we still have. The male is dominant. And because of that dominance, and it has to do with power and authority, it usually went back to a male. Thus, that language was built according to that mentality.
All the languages
yeah.
are made. All
yeah, exactly.
Even, you know, sometimes Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala use a masculine word. That's what I'm saying. Like, in Arabic language, when a masculine word is used, it also contains females as well in it. For example, if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when He says, Ya ayyuhal muslimun, O Muslims.
Right.
Now I'm translating in English. O Muslims. Do you separating the male Muslims and the female Muslims in the Muslims, plural form, or not? You're including all
the females are included.
They are also included. So basically, this is the capacity of the language. Even in English, when we say Muslims, we're putting an S. It means, it does not mean like it does not contain the females. It has males into it.
Right.
So this capacity is in the language. Like the Arabic language itself has this, we can say like prominency, that a masculine verb or word is used. On the other hand, we also have examples. For example, when a masculine word is being made as a broken plural. For example, we have rajul, which means man. Rijal means men. It's a plural form. Rijal is the plural form of a man. Now, all of them are men. But when we bring a verb, we bring a feminine verb for it. Nasarat ar-rijalu.
Mm-hmm.
Like the men helped.
Right.
Okay. Now, in the Arabic language, if we want to say like this, there is a contradiction. It looks like a contradiction. But it's in their language, in the structure, that whenever they have broken plural, not the sound plural. The difference between the broken plural and sound plural is in the sound plural, the rhythm or the alphabets that are used in the singular form, they remains, the order is same. It remains in the same order. Like Muslim, Muslimun.
Mm-hmm.
Muslimin, right. From Muslim. But when we want to make a broken plural, either we change the order of the alphabets or we add something into it. For example, kitab is book. Kitab. It has kaf, ta, alif, ba, four letters. Kutub, we removed alif. It becomes three. It's a broken plural. Now, although it's a masculine word, but when we need to bring anything, a pronoun for it, or if we want to bring a verb for it, the Arabs, they bring a feminine verb. Okay?
Right.
So this is the language structure.
The construction
of the language, which we need to understand. So basically, this question...
But you don't know the reason. Why do we use feminine suddenly?
For the broken
plural.
It's how the Arabs, they used.
All right.
Obviously, you know, in the languages, we need to follow the native speakers.
Right.
It is how the native speakers have used. So we do not have any reason for
it. So we can conclude, Sayyid, that the he's and the she's for God has no importance at all. God is gender free, like the angels are gender free. The he and the she's and the kings and the queens are used from the human perspective. We usually see in male-dominated societies that the king, the male member of the family, the father, they had dominance, they had authority, they had power. Thus, that was applied in the construction of the language, and thus it was applied in the revelation of the Noble Quran when it was revealed in the Arabic language in the Arabian Peninsula. And we have the same in the English language, where we say that he has the whole world in his hand, or he is the king, and so on and so forth.
And on top of that, if I want to just mention here,
yes,
that
sir,
after the death, our soul or spirit, nafs, it does not have any gender as well.
Right.
It does not have. Like after we die, when the souls have been transferred to the next realm, which is barzakh, or the hereafter, obviously there we will not see any genders like this, the way we have right now. Obviously at that time, you know, in the Quran it is said about Hurul Ain, a beautiful, we can say like angel, being a servant of the person, it will be given to the good people. Now, a lady in this world who is a woman in this world can have that Hurul Ain.
Yeah.
A man can also have the Hurul Ain. Because
it's a
this
general
nafs
term.
Spirit...
It's a general term,
yes,
for both male
for both
and
of them.
Beautiful male.
Now, when
we're
talking about the male and female in this world, with this specific body that we have, or the emotions and all those that we have, that is given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
But the barzakhi body will be male and female.
I'm talking about the hereafter.
Yeah, the barzakhi.
The barzakhi, yes.
It will be male and female.
When we're talking about this body that we have, being a male or female or man or woman, It is basically, these are the duties that Allah has given. Obviously, we are here for our trial in this world. And we need to go through this world. We need to work hard for hereafter. Now, in order to work hard for hereafter, there are some duties that are given. To my soul, being a man, this body is given to me. And I have to act like a man and do whatever is my duty. Socializing with the people, talking to the people publicly, working hard, bringing food for the family, being guardian of the family, and all those things. A lady who has got a soul, who has got the body of a female, she has a duty to train kids. She has the duty to train. A father cannot train kids. It's the job of the mother. A mother is a good teacher. From the lap, she starts teaching the kids, she trains them, and that's what it's her main duty, to give this society good people. When she trains...
With that said, Sayyid, it doesn't take away the responsibility of us fathers.
No. It does not
take...
The main responsibility of the house, training kids, raising up, obviously, it's on both of them.
Right.
But the main training, where when we talk about the tarbiyah,
details,
it is more related to the mother because she has more patience than the father.
She's
much more
much
emotional in order to taking care of them than the father.
Right.
So there the duties are changed, and this is related to this world only, not hereafter.
Thank you very much, Sayyid.
Jazakallah khairan.
And thank you, dear listeners, for joining us in this program of questions and answers on Islamic belief.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن
لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن
حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا
وبهذا الحب لنا شميحا.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Recently published satellite images by the International Panel on Fissile Material have revealed that Israel is expanding its Dimona nuclear facility in the Negev Desert. Israel has acknowledged the existence of the Dimona nuclear reactor, however it neither confirms nor denies the purpose of the facility. The site has provided the Israeli regime with the material needed for its nuclear arsenal. According to a report by a non-profit organization named Federation of American Scientists, in 2020, Israel possesses close to 100 atomic nuclear warheads that are made from plutonium produced in a Dimona heavy water reactor. However, other sources have put that figure at 300, with some estimates even going as far as 400 nuclear warheads. The Israeli regime has a deliberate ambiguity policy on its nuclear arsenal, which means despite being the only possessor of nuclear weapons in West Asia, it always refuses to accept or deny having any. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls on nuclear transparency, and it has never allowed any inspections of its nuclear facilities. With the US's invariable support, the regime has so far defied the international calls to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT. The treaty aims to halt the spread of nuclear arms and weapons technology. This is all while Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program and assassinated several nuclear scientists in recent years. However, Iran has rejected all these accusations, as it was among the first nations to sign the NPT. In January, Iran's permanent representative to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, denounced favoritism towards Israel by the International Atomic Agency. He said such a treatment has given the Israeli regime the audacity to ridicule the watchdog and press ahead with its advancing nuclear weapons program in defiance of international calls. Israel's possession of nuclear warhead poses a significant threat to regional stability. The regime has carried out bombing campaigns against Syria for the past years. It's threatened Iran militarily on numerous occasions. And when it comes to Hezbollah, Israel has repeatedly threatened to destroy the resistance group.
First of all, they want to keep it as secret as possible, but there's another reason for this, and it's because Israel gets a large amount of economic and military aid from the United States. It's the biggest recipient of U.S. aid. And there is a bill that was passed, I guess, 60 years ago, the Symington Amendment, which said that we cannot provide aid to any nation that has a nuclear weapon and is not part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Israel's name has been synonymous with aggression, illegal occupation, and war with regional countries, as well as other international crimes. In August 2018, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu threatened Iran with atomic annihilation, right from the regime's Dimona atomic weapons facility. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif slammed Netanyahu by calling his statement beyond shameless. The regime is the center of fabrications against Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which is subject to round-the-clock monitoring by the UN. Israel has made baseless allegations against Iran, saying it is developing nuclear weapons. Yet the regime owns atomic warheads and refrains from allowing inspections of its facilities. Unlike Iran, Israel has so far refused to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, whose aim is to prevent the spread of nuclear arms and weapons technology, in defiance of international pressure. Several countries have helped out Israel to develop its nuclear arsenal. They have secretly sold the Israeli regime material and expertise to build warheads. These nations include the US, France, Germany, Britain, and even Norway.
Well, you can draw the conclusion that perhaps the United States likes volatile regions. The more death and destruction, the better. It survives on this, and it invests extremely heavily in the most powerful military regime on the planet.
However, Israel's nuclear weapons project would never have succeeded without a major contribution from France. Surprisingly, Paris took the toughest line on counter-proliferation when it came to Iran's peaceful nuclear program, whilst at the same time it helped lay the foundations of the Israeli regime's atomic weapons. Whilst Israel has fabricated accusations against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, it's the only possessor of atomic warheads in the West Asia region. There have been growing calls for a region free of nuclear weapons. So why then have the US and Europe themselves turned a deaf ear to such demands?
U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has announced three symbolic gestures toward Iran in an apparent break with former President Donald Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. Ned Price, a spokesman for the State Department, said Thursday the Biden administration was willing to meet with Iranian officials and other world powers involved in negotiating the nuclear deal. Price said Washington would accept an invitation from the European Union's top diplomat to attend a meeting aimed to discuss a diplomatic way forward on Iran's nuclear program.
Well, the U.S. is trying to play a little game here by saying, I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to meet Iranians and I want to talk about the JCPOA, and maybe the U.S. will lift some sanctions. It's just the message the U.S. is just not getting it right. The U.S. needs to understand when Iran stops giving false hope that there is no return to the JCPOA unless the Americans lift all sanctions, apply the lifting of the sanctions, allow Iran to sell its oil and to make deal with other companies as stated in JCPOA, and then Iran will stop withdrawing from the nuclear deal.
Washington says it has lifted travel restrictions on Iranian diplomats accredited to the United Nations, headquartered in New York, limitations that were imposed by Trump in 2019. Also, in a letter to the UN Security Council on behalf of Biden, Acting U.S. Ambassador Richard Mills said the United States has withdrawn three letters from the Trump administration that claimed the U.S. had reimposed U.N. sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Mills said that sanctions measures terminated in Resolution 2231 endorsing the nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, with six world powers, remain terminated. This is while the overwhelming majority of the members in the 15-nation council had described Trump's bid to restore UN embargoes on Iran as illegal, arguing the U.S. was no longer a member of the JCPOA. In a tweet, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif responded to the U.S. acknowledgement that the snapback mechanism of the JCPOA has not been triggered. He reiterated Iran's position that Washington must lift all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled under the Trump administration before Tehran reverses its scaleback of the commitments under the nuclear accord. Zarif had earlier urged France, Britain, and Germany, three European signatories to the nuclear agreement, to abandon their calls on Iran to act first to salvage the JCPOA and instead demand an end to the U.S. quote, economic terrorism on Tehran. In a reaction to the U.S. announcement that it would accept the EU's invitation to a meeting of Iran and the P5+1, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said P5+1 no longer exists due to Washington's withdrawal from the deal. He repeated Iranian officials' stance that the U.S. must first put its words into action before Tehran follows suit. Even after the U.S. exit from the JCPOA and the reimposition of sanctions, Iran remained fully committed to the accord for a year before gradually reducing its commitments in five steps, citing the failure of the European signatories to the deal to keep their end of the bargain.
Iran made it very clear the government is forced to abide by the decision of the parliament, and the parliament decided to implement several steps, one after the other. The first one is the 21st of February, and on the 21st of February, Iran will withdraw from the voluntary protocol and will reduce the sudden inspection of the atomic energy inspector. Therefore, the Americans need to understand that there are other steps that will follow if the sanctions are not lifted.
The country has times and again noted that all the retaliatory steps are reversible once all signatories honor their obligations.
Myanmar has been the scene of mass demonstrations against junta leaders ever since the February 1 coup. Anti-coup protesters have defied a crackdown by the military, taking to the streets in several cities across the country almost daily. Demonstrators are demanding the release of the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who was detained along with a number of parliament members. They're also demanding the restoration of civilian rule. Myanmar's junta has ratcheted up security measures to quell anti-coup demonstrations, and the internet in Yangon has been down for several days. Junta leaders deny they staged a coup and justified their power seizure by alleging widespread voter fraud in November elections that Suu Kyi's party won. They also pledge to hold new elections soon. This, however, has failed to calm down the situation.
I guess a lot of times with the Burma army and the Burmese dictators, they are always above the law. So why he doesn't calm the situation is because he doesn't want to calm the situation, because he wants things to be under his control, and he wanted to hold on to the power the way he wants to run the country. And that is why, although you will see a lot of chaotic going on, and you would think that if he is sincere about, if he's talking about the election issues and election is fraud, if that is the case, then why violence?
The army generals have filed multiple charges against the deposed leader, including ignoring an import and export law over walkie-talkies that were found in her home during the search. The Nobel laureate's lawyer says she has also been hit with a second charge, which is violating the country's disaster management law. Observers believe the accusations against Suu Kyi are an indication that the military is seeking a permanent grip on power.
Nobody knows how long the military is going to hold on to the power, but it is very worrisome that they probably may not want to let go the power, because for so many reasons, especially those who are in power, like high-ranking position like Mae Aung-le. He has so much political ambition in order to become the president, and even more so in order to control and have control over his own economic ambitions.
The military seizure of power has drawn global reactions. The United Nations has warned the army of several consequences of any harsh response to protesters. The UN Special Rapporteur said Myanmar's generals will be held accountable for any suppression of the civil disobedience campaign there. The coup also drew reactions from other international players. China said the situation in Myanmar is not what Beijing wants to see. It also rejected social media rumors that China was involved in the coup as complete nonsense. However, China, along with Russia, says the coup is Myanmar's internal affair. The United States, however, has taken a different stance. Last Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden announced new sanctions on those responsible for the coup and any entities linked to junta leaders. Biden said Washington will be ready to impose additional measures. There is also the risk of a new confrontation between U.S. and China, maybe over Myanmar.
I mean, look, yes, the U.S. is talking about threatening to impose sanctions, targeted sanctions especially. And what did they do in the past week? They did impose some targeted sanctions, but it's just on, what, on the gems companies? But the most important thing to follow, to go behind, is the oil and gas company that is owned by the military. That is where they make a whole bunch of money in order to buy their submarines, their warplanes, all kinds of sophisticated weapons, which we call Mag and Mel, the oil company. They didn't do anything about it. That is something we wanted to see the U.S. will sanction.
The two nuclear-armed countries are already facing off on a range of other issues, including the U.S. interference in China's periphery, such as the South China Sea and the Korean Peninsula, as well as the trade and cyber wars between them. Myanmar is just another geopolitical war threat for China and the U.S., but observers believe Beijing has an edge over Washington in this struggle.
Saudi Arabia could not have it any better. As soon as the former U.S. President Donald Trump came into office, it was evident that he intended to solidify the relationship with Saudi Arabia even more than before. And the businessman that Trump was, that translated into weapon sales to Saudi Arabia.
$533 million.
The Saudis were more than happy to comply. Through their weapons purchases, they also bought the loyalty of the U.S. president when it came to their wrongdoings, like their human rights violations, and of course, the Saudi war in Yemen, and the grave violations that were taking place there. The U.S. president even shielded the Crown Prince from the brutal murder assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, which the world condemned as a heinous crime. That included the current U.S. President Joe Biden, an act which may have been the straw that broke the camel's back when it came to Saudi Arabia and the Crown Prince. This may explain why Joe Biden has announced that King Salman is whom he would communicate with in Saudi Arabia, and not Bin Salman, even though Bin Salman is in fact the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia.
And on Saudi Arabia, I would say, you know, we've made clear from the beginning that we're going to recalibrate our relationship with Saudi Arabia, and that, you know, President Biden, on one of the questions there was also, just to go back to the context of it, whether he would be speaking with MBS. And part of that is going back to engagement counterpart to counterpart. The president's counterpart is King Salman. And I expect that an appropriate time, he would have a conversation with him. I don't have a prediction of the timeline on that.
I think that the significance of this snub of Biden's statement is the suggestion that by the White House or Biden will not consider Saudi Arabia as synonymous with Mohammed bin Salman, but rather seek to establish a relationship with Saudi Arabia that does not uniquely or exclusively depend on Mohammed bin Salman. And of course, that can carry many meanings. At the moment, it just seems to be a statement of significance in expressing the intentions of the Biden administration to rein in Mohammed bin Salman.
The Saudi Crown Prince, however, was forewarned of Biden's stance towards him. Biden used pretty tough language specifically against Mohammed bin Salman during his campaign trail, calling him a pariah. Tough language that the Saudis were not used to hearing. Even though the U.S. President Joe Biden claims that human rights is a barometer when it comes to Saudi Arabia, then why would it sell weapons to other countries, like in the case of Egypt, in which President Sisi is known for rights abuses in that country? The U.S. President has plans for West Asia or the Middle East region that goes beyond Saudi Arabia and Israel. The region's security is still very much a concern for the U.S., but regional dynamics and equations may be changing. First off, ending the U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
If the U.S. wants to establish regional security, it will need the Islamic Republic of Iran. The U.S. realizes the military power that Iran possesses, and without this power, the region will be in flux due to tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia and Israel and with the resistance groups in the region. In order for this to be solved, the U.S. realizes that it has no choice other than to rejoin the JCPOA. This can decrease tensions significantly, even though both Saudi Arabia and Israel are not enthusiastic about this, nor do they support it. Iran is also looking for regional stability, but without U.S. presence in the region. This comes in the form of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani's vision for peace called the Hormuz Peace Initiative, or the Hormuz Peace Plan, in order to establish security in the region, including the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, and the Sea of Oman. This will involve regional countries.
The message coming from Biden is that while we are not lifting sanctions, we are offering concessions in other places, in other issues. And I think for Iran in particular, it's a matter of to what extent can we trust the U.S. to lift the sanctions if we do eventually come to a deal.
But why would the U.S. be after this approach to West Asia? The Pentagon, at Biden's direction, has undertaken a review of changes that need to be made to U.S. military deployments worldwide, with an eye towards countering the growing threat from China. West Asia is no longer a number one priority for the U.S. It remains to be seen, however, if the U.S. lifts Iran's sanctions in order for this plan to bear fruit and for Iran to return to the JCPOA. The U.S. President Joe Biden's approach towards Saudi Arabia changing, however, is just a mirage, since Saudi Arabia has continued bombing Yemen and throughout all the previous U.S. administrations, and despite U.S. promises made, the U.S. support has not changed, neither for Saudi Arabia nor for Israel.
Welcome to The Light. Feeling frustrated and stressed out, Brazilians have found a place to vent their anger and fury in the newly opened Rage Room. Inside a warehouse on the outskirts of Sao Paulo, people can freely swing giant hammers at old televisions, computers and printers. Demolishing the machines and shattering glass into tiny pieces helps to release their pent-up feelings. The 42-year-old who opened the business a month ago says he has received a fair number of customers wanting to vent, especially during the pandemic.
I think it was the best moment to be able to set this up here, related to everything that people are going through, a lot of anxiety, stress. Sometimes people miss work or even work a lot at home. I believe this here is like an escape at the moment.
Wearing protective suits and helmets, participants write issues that bother them on the walls, turning the words into targets of their anger. One might think how much it costs to break all these things up. The Rage Room experience, however, costs just less than $5.
Niagara Falls on the US-Canada borders is known for its spectacular timeless beauty, attracting tourists, especially during the summer. But this year's frigid temperature has created another spectacular scene at this natural wonder. Visitors to the New York side of the falls were treated with a remarkable view, as stream falling down the Niagara River is now crusted with ice. A rainbow adds more beauty, leading to the most amazing view of the falls. Every day, dozens of people help each other walk across icy stream to take a closer look at the beauty created by the extreme cold weather. More snowfall, low temperature have been predicted for the coming days, meaning people will have more time to enjoy the place.
Tens of thousands of flamingos have turned the Indian city of Navi Mumbai pink. Bird lovers gathered near a lake to watch the migrating flamingos. Every year, flamingos migrate to Navi Mumbai between October and March. They go there from northern and western parts of India and sometimes as far away as Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran. Then they fly out in June. This year and last year, their numbers were much higher. Experts say that is because the lake is cleaner thanks to COVID lockdowns. Well, the world's largest snow maze is once again welcoming visitors in Western Canada, offering them a joyful adventure amid the coronavirus pandemic. The attraction opened in mid-February after being in limbo earlier in the winter due to public health measures and unseasonably warm weather. In addition to the giant maze, there are also snow slides as well as snow buildings and huts with artworks inside so the visitors can enjoy other activities besides getting lost. The massive labyrinth is about 240,000 square feet, twice the size of its record-breaking build in 2019. Designers say the larger layout is a nod to social distancing guidelines.
In 2019, we applied for the title of the world's largest snow maze, which we got in February. And this year, just with COVID and everything, we wanted to make it bigger. And so this year, it's about 91% bigger than the world's largest title that we hold now.
The visitors can only have 5 people in their group, and masks and face coverings are mandatory. Indoor warming areas are closed and picnic tables are also unavailable due to the pandemic.
Now, after an unprecedented winter storm in some parts of the United States, people in Texas have rushed to rescue sea turtles. The creatures are not used to chilly weather, so they became cold stunned. This is a condition in which sea turtles remain awake but lose the ability to move. Volunteers have so far saved over 4,700 of them off the southern coast of Texas. The rescued turtles were transferred to a convention center and will be freed after the water becomes warmer.
There is a famous quote that love and kindness are never wasted. An Australian couple has proved that this maxim doesn't apply to humans alone. Chrissy Jarrett and her partner Matthew have been rescuing animals for the past 10 years and have saved dozens of kangaroos. The couple is volunteers with the New South Wales Wildlife Information Rescue and Education Service. Many of the rescued animals were taken from pouches of their dead mothers after they were hit by cars. Chrissy says caring for distressed kangaroos gives her a kind of sensation she cannot get from anything else.
It was such an eye-opener to learn how very human they were, how emotional, how, you know, interactive. They're not pets, they are wild animals, but they are so amazing to learn about, and that's something that I think wildlife care gives me that I can't get anywhere else.
Once the rescued animals are in a good enough condition, they are set free during a process that is called soft release. That is when the gate is left open so the kangaroos can come and go at will until they feel safe enough to leave for good. Some animals continue to visit their saviors even years after they were released.
If you walk through London these days, you'll spot tiny handmade shops in some places. Let's see what they offer. The shops have been created by an artist to encourage people to donate non-perishable food to charities. Sean Rodrigo makes wooden miniature food banks and puts them in different areas. He uses 3D printer to create his artwork. Rodrigo believes decorated boxes shaped like shops grab people's attention. Each box holds about 35 cans.
How would the Milky Way look like if it fell from the sky? Maybe similar to a magnificent scenery created by the freezing temperature in northeastern China. Frozen waterfalls in China's Jingpo Lake present a stunning view that attracts visitors even during the coldest days of the year. The chilly weather freezes the waterfalls from side to side with thick layers that are up to 15 meters high. The icy layers cover the cliffs, and they are sometimes as wide as 300 meters. But surprisingly, and unlike the waterfalls, the lake itself never freezes and is ice-free all around the year because of its underground hot springs.
Italy witnessed an amazing natural scenery. This one, however, is all about heat and smoke. Footage taken from Italy's Mount Etna shows thick plumes of rose-colored smoke rising into the sky while red lava turning the mountain slope into a glowing river. Europe's tallest active volcano burst into a new eruption earlier this week in the Sicilian town of Catania. Despite a rain of stones and ashes, authorities said the eruption has not been worrying. Mount Etna has erupted frequently in the past 500,000 years. Its last major eruption was back in 1992.
It's really difficult and often painful to put a smile on kids' faces, especially when they're sick and they are suffering from chronic diseases. But a group in superhero costumes in Austria has taken a courageous move to cheer up young patients on International Childhood Cancer Day. Vienna's Special Forces police officers agreed to visit the children's hospital dressing up as Spider-Man, Batman and other superheroes. The young patients were excited and delighted to see them through windows while they scrawled on the walls of the hospital. The officers' brass band also played familiar songs from Star Wars to amuse the children. The visit was planned by hospital officials and volunteer officers in order to cheer up these little warriors who are fighting the diseases every day.
Thai brides and grooms have said, "I do," in a special wedding ceremony on Valentine's Day. 59 couples tied the knot on elephants during the ceremony in Thailand's Chonburi province. The elephant bag wedding is actually an annual event. It takes place in a botanical garden. In previous years, over 100 couples attended the ceremony, but this year, the number was half that due to the pandemic.
Humans are not the only ones having fun with snowfall. Two giant baby pandas at a Belgian zoo are also taking the advantage of the winter and having a blast playing in the snow. Bao Di and Bao Mi, translated as a little brother of Bao and little sister of Bao, were caught on camera enjoying their first winter at Pieri Diazza. The overly excited, adorable babies were rolling, tumbling around, and even eating in the snow. The zookeeper says that the body of the pandas is in a shape that makes them comfortable in the cold. With the birth of these two babies in August 2019, the privately owned Belgian zoo is now home to five giant pandas. Piazza Diazza is called Europe's best zoo, which consists of botanical garden and an animal theme park.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
IRIB English Radio.